Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning again, everyone. And here's a mid-June media ritual. Supreme Court correspondents wait for the opinions to be announced at 10 a.m. and then have to not only read the opinions, but quickly write a clever lead to their stories before filing them for everybody to read. In radio, it's a little easier. That was just my lead. Let's talk with Emily Bazelon of Slate about today's opinions, including the ruling striking down some of President Obama's recess appointments and making it easier for Congress to keep blocking appointments by juking the calendar. We'll also touch on a couple of other cases, including a buffer zone around abortion clinics being struck down and a circuit court ruling on gay marriage in Utah that may be headed to the Supreme Court, yet another nail in the coffin, I think, of anti-gay marriage laws. Emily Bazelon, welcome back to WNYC.
Thank you, Brian. I love that introduction because now whatever I screw up, your listeners will have sympathy for me.
Absolutely. So low expectations is the path to success.
That's the key.
At Slate, apparently. Let's start with that recess ruling. This was about three recess appointments to the National Labor Relations Board made by President Obama. Not exactly water cooler conversation, but the court says those were not valid. How come?
Well, the Constitution gives the power to the president to make appointments when the Senate is in recess and can't quickly confirm or reject. So the question is, what is the scope of that recess appointment? And what the court said unanimously, sort of, there's a big fight about reasoning, but unanimously in the judgment, was that President Obama could not appoint these folks to the National Labor Relations Board because it was a very short recess in the middle of a congressional session, only 3 days. And also, the Senate itself said that it was in session. And the court said that if the Senate does that and has the capability to do business, that is good enough to stop the president.
So the court did hold that the president can fill any executive vacancy during intra or intersession recess. So it's really about the kind of recess during which an appointment is made.
Exactly. So the court could have gone so far, and this is what four conservative justices led by Justice Scalia would have liked. The court could have said the president only has the power to make recess appointments when Congress is between sessions, the end of one congressional session and the beginning of another. And so Justice Breyer, for five justices, says no. He says it is possible for a president to make recess appointments in the middle of a congressional session when Congress is out on break. And he points to historical practice. He says, actually, there have been thousands of these kinds of appointments, so we need to continue to make room for them.
And on that point, a line from something that we read just before you came on said, the court also holds that the recess does not have to occur. I'm going to say it again. The court also holds that the recess does not have to occur during the recess. And, of course, that's an argument that third graders have been making for ages.
Right. I mean, the great thing about this case is it really all turns in some ways on the meaning of the word the. What did the framers of the Constitution mean when they said the recess? Justice Scalia wants the recess to mean only the recess between congressional sessions. And when you're just looking at the text, you can see what his point is. But Justice Breyer and the majority say, look, Congress, the president, we've all been doing it another way for 150 years, and we're not going to get in the way with that, at least not literally speaking.
So does anybody win and lose here? Do liberals win and conservatives lose or vice versa? Or does the executive branch win? Does presidential power win over congressional power to stop presidential appointments? Who actually wins?
Well, President Obama lost because these appointments he made to the NLRB are going to go down, and that's going to call into question a whole bunch of rulings that the NLRB made. And then, you know, in theory, presidential power had a victory here in that on paper, the president can make these intercession recess appointments. But I have to say, and I'm still sorting this out, desperately emailing with constitutional law scholars, it seems to me that the most important part of the opinion is the part where the court says the Senate gets to make its own rules. Because if that's true, then I think the Senate can decide whether it is having a recess or not. And one additional thing that's important here is this particular recess was blocked by not the majority leader, but by Mitch McConnell, the minority leader. And that suggests that a minority of the Senate can decide that it's in session by just gaveling in and out, even if everyone's on vacation. That suggests to me that, practically speaking, the president could emerge with a lot less power to make recess appointments.
So the court basically reaffirmed what anyone who works in an office already knows. He who controls the shared calendar holds all the power. But let me go back to something that you just said a minute ago that's really provocative, which is that the appointments that are being rolled back here are of actual individuals to an actual government agency, the National Labor Relations Board. Were you saying that some of the decisions that they have actually made regarding particular unionization fights or labor standards or workers' grievances, whatever, may actually be voided now because these people were not legitimately appointed?
Yes, absolutely. There was a whole year in which there were these three appointees that Obama made, and they were made during this particular recess, non-recess, that the court has just said that the nominations are not valid. And so those rulings are now all thrown into confusion. The question is, could the NLRB just go back and reaffirm them all? Because now those people have been reappointed, and there's not a big question. There actually still is a question over one of them. But most of the NLRB, it's now clear, can legitimately make decisions. So could they just go back and reaffirm them all, or do they have to actually rehear the cases? There's going to be a lot more litigation about that.
This is WNYC FM HD and AM New York, WNJT FM 88.1 Trenton, WNJO 90.3 Toms River, WNJY 89.3 Netcong, and WNJP 88.5 Sussex, New York and New Jersey Public Radio. As we're breaking down this morning's Supreme Court rulings with Emily Bazelon from Slate. Okay, another notable ruling from today. The court holds that a Massachusetts law that imposed a 35-foot buffer zone around abortion clinics violates the First Amendment. This is about where protesters could be?
Yes, exactly. And the problem with this law from the point of view of free speech is that it blocked people in peaceful protests from standing on the sidewalk outside abortion clinics in Massachusetts.
But was this ruling about the particular distance or the idea of a buffer zone in general? I mean, does this mean that the so-called free speech zones or protest areas that you see at all kinds of events, not just around abortion clinics, are unconstitutional as well?
It's not that broad. So this is another weird one that appears to be 9-0, striking down this particular no protest zone, but actually there's a 5-4 split about the scope of the ruling and the reasoning behind it. So the five justices in the majority, it's Roberts plus the liberal moderates on the court. And they said, look, Massachusetts has not shown they need to have this no protest zone to keep clinic workers and patients safe. There have been actually no prosecutions for harassment or intimidation or violence. And so the court said to Massachusetts, go back, make a narrower law that addresses behavior that is not peaceful protest on the sidewalk, and that could still be okay.
Maybe there have been no violations for harassment because of the buffer zone.
That is exactly what Massachusetts argued, and the court said, you know what, sorry, in this case, that's not good enough. You can't just say, well, we've prevented all these problems, that's how we can show the law is working.
Because what they're trying to prevent largely is not that they're going to block access to the abortion clinic, but that women might know that it's such a hostile environment just to get to the front door with people calling the murderers in their face or holding up signs to that effect in what might be considered a more peaceful protest because it's in writing. I don't know that that's really what they're trying to prevent with this, right?
Yeah, exactly. And what the court is saying is that the First Amendment just doesn't allow for shielding women from offensive or you know, cruel speech like that. And this is very much in line with the very pro, almost, you could argue, extremist view of the First Amendment that this court has taken. So a couple years ago, there was another case about hate-filled protests at a military funeral. And the court said that has to be allowed too. So we have a court here that is very uncomfortable with blocking speech because it's offensive or, you know, even beyond offensive. The court just says we have to let people talk.
And I wonder if this case pits two liberal tendencies against each other. Liking protest and free speech, but wanting to keep people from being intimidated at clinics. Maybe if it was a different situation, if it was a buffer zone between the workers who, between the protesters and the workers who were going in to make nuclear weapons, you know, that progressives would be on different sides of this.
Good point. I mean, I think the court made the right call today because if it is still possible to protect patients and abortion clinic workers from harassment or violence or intimidation. And saying that, to go so far as to say you're not going to allow protest on the public sidewalk, that's really pretty far in terms of limiting free speech. And the plaintiffs in this case did a great job. They, you know, they found this a grandmother who was just like standing there with a baby stroller trying to talk gently, she said, to protesters. So it's not like these were really in-your-face, scary-seeming people.
Listeners, any comments on the Supreme Court rulings that we're discussing today with Emily Bazelon from Slate or anything else that the court has done in this term? You can raise it. You can comment on it. You can ask a question about it. 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. And I should say that while all eyes were on the Supreme Court, as it happened, the 10th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals, a lower court, upstaged the justices yesterday and upheld a ruling that made gay marriage legal in Utah of all places. But wait, didn't the voters of Utah vote against gay marriage?
They did indeed. And this is a big deal, this ruling, because it's the first federal appeals court since the ruling last June in which the Supreme Court struck down the Defense of Marriage Act. And what the Tenth Circuit is saying is that it's really becoming plain that to ban gay marriage is a violation of the constitutional protection for equal treatment for everyone. And there is what's becoming the kind of standard stirring language about equality and how marriage is a fundamental right, and how there is just absolutely no legitimate reason to deny this to gay couples. So this court stayed this ruling. That means it won't go into effect immediately in Utah. But this really sends a signal that we are on the way to having gay marriage across the land. And the question is just how that is going to unfold.
It seems like there's a court ruling about gay marriage every other week. And yet this seems really significant in what it suggests for the future of banning gay marriage in any state and whether it's a state-by-state proposition at all under the U.S. Constitution.
Well, that's exactly right. By my count, there are now 20 rulings since last June, and they have all been in favor of gay marriage. So we are in this funny position that would have been unthinkable even 3 years ago, in which we're waiting for a court to rule against gay marriage so that there can be the kind of split that the Supreme Court might take an interest in. I'm actually, my bet is on the court that's called the Fifth Circuit. That's the one that's in Texas and Louisiana and another southern state I'm forgetting right this second. And so if that court ruled against gay marriage, then you might see the Supreme Court having to step in. But what's kind of amazing is the consensus among the lower courts that this is what the Constitution in 2014 provides.
Let's take a call from John in Paramus on one of the decisions that came down yesterday and that we talked about on yesterday morning show regarding the cell phones and police searches. Hi, John. You're on WNYC.
Yes, I'm sorry I missed you yesterday. But I just think, you know, I understand the privacy issue and whatnot, and I know sometimes the police can be a little invasive with people. But I think it's really going to hamper their police work. Detaining people and whatnot. I don't know if it's the right decision to do.
Emily, you want to comment? We didn't have you yesterday, so you didn't get a shot here on the Supreme Court saying that the police cannot search everything on your cell phone if they arrest you for something in particular.
Yeah. great question. We'll have to see how it plays out. You know, it's important to remember the cops can still look on your cell phone once they get a warrant. And as the justice has pointed out, it's getting faster and faster to get a warrant. You know, the cops can do it basically from their cars in like 10 or 15 minutes. So when you think about it that way, what you're basically doing is creating some kind of protection against just willy-nilly searching the cell phones of the 12 million people who get arrested in this country every year. You know, you're just asking a court to sign off on the need for that kind of search.
Is it that easy?
Yeah, it really is that easy. I mean, usually, you know, you get a warrant from a magistrate judge and the police just basically have to say, this is why I want to look. I think this person, I've arrested this person and now I want to search their phone for evidence that connects to their arrest or because I have probable cause to suspect them of someone else. It's not a high bar.
And yet, it was a unanimous ruling on the Supreme Court yesterday, 9-0, meaning they feel strongly about protecting people's privacy. In this case, as they've been a very strong, I think, pro-privacy court in general.
Well, it's interesting. This case is much more robust and forceful than some of their past decisions about search and seizure had been. And you're right. I mean, this one really was unanimous. And they're basically saying, we understand that cell phones are different in terms of their privacy implications than your wallet or your billfold or all the other things that you carry on your person that previously the court had said, well, if you get arrested, the cops can look at all that stuff. They were really at pains to say, we understand that cell phones have huge storage capacities that people carry around basically all their personal data. And so it's different to say that the police can search them without a warrant.
So does this ruling say anything about the court's willingness to reset the balance between security and privacy? In other words, does this say anything about the NSA, the stuff that Edward Snowden talks about?
Not directly, but I think it suggests that the court is thinking hard about privacy implications, and I know that pro-privacy advocates were pretty excited yesterday. So the big question here is there's this old 1979 ruling in which the Supreme Court said that it's not a privacy violation for the government to look at phone metadata without a warrant. And it's really pretty outdated. You know, it's 1979, and they're basically saying, hey, if you tell your phone company who you're calling, that's enough to say that it's fine for the phone company to hand over that information to the government. I think our conception of what we're the privacy we're giving up at that moment has shifted because of NSA surveillance. And so it will be really interesting to see what happens when the court takes up that question in the future.
212-433-WNYC. And I think Peter in Union has a question about the abortion clinic buffer zone ruling. Peter, you're on WNYC. Hi.
Hello. My question is specifically this. That was a clinic that provided services for women. But what if it were my own home and I were to be under the spotlight and people were then to wanting to protest against me personally? What is my personal buffer zone around my own house? Does the court's opinion relate to that? Is it my sidewalk, the access way, my sidewalk, little sidewalk that leads up to the main sidewalk, my lawn, my front porch, because they can come and ring my doorbell? It sort of seems like then without the buffer zone, it's right up to my door, and then, you know, I can shut my door, and inside my door is only my safe zone. You see, you follow me?
Emily, does it go that far?
I do follow you. These are great questions. They're tricky questions because the court didn't address any of that yesterday. So I'm now going to like go back to more general knowledge and the way the law usually works. It is true that people who are soliciting, you know, like the Jehovah's Witnesses who knock on your door, they have the right to come all the way up to your door. If someone is protesting, though, the state can make a law limiting them for being on your private property. That's the part of First Amendment law that's called a time, place, and manner restriction. It's the same reason that, you know, people can't sound a bullhorn in your neighborhood in the middle of the night and say, hey, I can make as much noise as I want. I have the First Amendment on my side. So all of those kinds of restrictions on speech can still apply.
Wasn't there a cross-burning ruling from the Supreme Court like a decade ago that spoke to this? Because that was on people's lawns, wasn't it?
Yes, that is very much connected. That case is from 2003, and that one is about what constitutes a true threat. And the court said that merely burning a cross on someone's lawn isn't a true threat. True threats are outside of First Amendment protection. You're not allowed to go around, you know, really threatening people. And but the court said that in that case that there wasn't enough proof of what the protesters meant to signify with their cross burning. It's not my favorite ruling. That seems a little silly to me.
Though I have to say, this buffer zone reading has gotten people on our Twitter feed really worried. Some people are starting to tweet stories of harassment at clinics and wondering what's going to happen now to women going for abortions as a result of this ruling.
Harassment can still be against the law. Harassment and a peaceful protest are two different things. And so, you know, I think that what the police are still going to be able to do is limit what protesters can do on the sidewalk outside a clinic. It's just that the protesters now have the right to stand there and talk. It doesn't mean they have the right to block your way or prevent you from going in. It's about what they can say to you.
Steve on the Upper West Side, you're on WNYC. Hi, Steve.
Hi. I'm just curious if the cell phone ruling only concerns state and local police or if it also extends to U.S. Customs, for instance, at the borders.
Interesting.
Ooh, what a good question.
Without a warrant, you're coming into the country, you have a passport from this nation or any other, and for whatever reason, well, of course, you have to be arrested first. That's what this applies to, right, the Supreme Court ruling. So if Customs arrest you, can they then look at everything in your, you know, we had an On the Media producer who went public with a story of being detained, not arrested, but detained as she was trying to come back into this country from Canada. And at that point, without a warrant, can customs officials look at everything in your cell phone?
Okay, so this sounds like a really good next challenge. Here's my guess. I think that right now, because you're trying to get into the country, that customs can look at anything they want, right? Someone, though, could argue that in light of this case, we should limit the power of customs officials to look at everything on your cell phone unless they have a warrant. But I don't think that this case, this decision, will get us there on its own.
I do believe in the case of my colleague, they confiscated the cell phones of at least some of the people who were involved in that moment, and who knows what they looked at. But John in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Hi. Thanks. I wondered what the buffers, this ruling means for these so-called free speech zones during the political conventions. They were relegating people blocks and blocks away, claiming security reasons, but it was clearly they just didn't want them in camera shot.
Right.
Yeah, that's another great question. I mean, this case is definitely about the clinics in particular, but I think what you see here is the court being unhappy about the idea of people keeping people off the sidewalk. Although I have to say, you know, they have a rule against protest on their own plaza, and that's because they've made this kind of fishy decision that that plaza is not actually a public space, which seems, frankly, kind of ridiculous in their way of just insulating themselves.
One of your namesakes, Emily, on our comments page, has a suggestion. Add a buffer zone around the Supreme Court.
Of course, yes, well, there is one already. They ban all demonstrations and speechifying on their own plaza, as I was saying, because they've said that that's not a traditional public forum. But your previous caller was asking about, sidewalks outside of political conventions, all that kind of stuff. So I'd say that it's going to be harder for states to justify those laws now. They could still come in maybe as time, place, and manner restrictions, but that's, again, a future challenge you could see getting teed up.
So we're almost out of time. Can I end by asking a question that we ask every year? In fact, I think I could have just cut and pasted this from last year's conversation around this time. Why in the world does the Supreme Court behave this way in terms of issuing opinions? Is it really too much to ask them to release a schedule and we'll say we'll release this opinion on this day, that opinion on that day? We didn't know if buffer zones was going to come down today, if Obamacare contraception coverage was going to come down today. It would save so much anxiety, so many tentative bookings of people like you who don't know whether you're going to actually be asked to go on unless this thing happens at 10:05 or not.
I mean, Brian, it would make my life so much easier if they would adopt such a schedule. The reason they don't have that schedule is they don't have to. Nobody can make them adopt it. It's the reason they don't put all their arguments on TV. They get to make their own rules. And I think really what's driving this is just some of these opinions are being haggled over and fought over and edited up until the very last minute, and they don't want to make a promise about what they're handing out until they're really ready. And I guess I don't think this justifies not having a schedule, but the other thing I'll throw out there is that if people know in advance what the outcome of a ruling is going to be, they can bet on it. Like, that could affect the stock market in some cases. Not when you're talking about abortion clinic buffer zones, but in a business case. I don't see, though, why that justifies not having a schedule. In fact, I just think it's crazy not to have a schedule.
Of course, judging from their recess appointments opinion, they clearly love other people's calendars. But I guess this means Hobby Lobby is going to come on Monday, the one that, you know, are corporations people, are, you know, do women have access to contraception through Obamacare, regardless of the religious beliefs of the owners of a private corporation? That decision, Monday, yes?
Yes, we know that's Monday because Monday's the last day. And the one other case hanging out there, which is a big deal, is whether unions will still have the right to collect dues from people who they represent but are not members. That's the current state of affairs. It's been that way since the 70s. If the Supreme Court reverses that ruling or limits it dramatically, that will really hurt unions across the country. And it looks like, just playing the game of how many opinions each justice has written in every month, that probably Justice Alito or maybe Justice Roberts is the author of that union decision. And that is not good news for unions.
What are you doing around this time on Monday? Never mind. I don't like to make plans. Emily Bazelon watches the Supreme Court for Slate. Thanks a lot.
Thanks for having me.